tonight is from Anderson, downtown group. He's a resident from New York. I was at the meeting, the first meeting he'd come to down here in South Carolina. I was there, and I asked him, I said, "Are you a Yankee or a damn Yankee?" And he said, "What's the difference?" I said, "Well, a Yankee come down and they go back home." But I said, "A damn Yankee's kind of like a person with a hemorrhoid." I said, "They come down, they won't go back up, and they're a pain in the butt." But this man is a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, and he's also my sponsor. And I don't call on him too much, but when I do call on him, he's always there, and he's always got the right answer. I was watching the ball game one time, and I called him up, and I said, "Tom," I said, "these gear commercials is tearing me out of the frame." I said, "I'm wanting to watch this ball game," and I said, "I'm about ready to climb a wall." He said, "You get you a glass of tea, fill it full of ice, go back in there and sit down, and you sip on that tea and watch that ball game." And you know, it worked. It really worked. And the next day I called him, I said, "What do you do when the pantyhose commercial comes up?" He said, "Take the ice out of the glass and dump it in your lap." He's a very intelligent man. I'm not going to stand up here and take up all his time. Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Tom W.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tom White, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you think I'm going to stand up here after that, you're crazy. You know, did you ever stop and think why we stand up, or even when we're at closed meetings and we go around the tables and we say our name and then we say I'm an alcoholic, or I'm an addict, or I'm a chemically dependent? Do you ever think of why we do that? You know, if you stop and think about it, the most important thing in my life is the fact that I recognized that I had a problem. My life changed. My world turned around. And I started to live for the first time in my life once I realized that I had a problem. So what better way to remind myself on a daily or a semi-daily or a weekly basis as to when I go to meetings to say I'm Tom White and I'm an alcoholic? What I'm doing is I'm identifying a problem that I have. You people obviously have the same problem called addiction. But I'm also taking ownership of it and saying I want to do something about it. And that's why we're all here, don't you think? And I think it's important to realize that it's not just lip service. It's not just running off at the jaw. It's not trying to be comical by, saying some snide remark before or after your name. I think it's very important to recognize the fact of who you are and what you are, where you're going, and how you're going to get there. And the only way I ever got any place was with 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure, I grew up in a very good home, a wonderful home. I had a great mom and dad. They were both Irish Catholics. I was raised in the church. I learned all the commandments. I learned how to break them all, too, and like all of us did, I guess. But the most important thing is that I can't sit here or stand here tonight and say to you, "Well, it was a problem because my mother and father were bad to me. I had a lousy environment. I had this, that, and the other thing. Job wasn't right. The boss wasn't right. My friends weren't right," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've all used those excuses, have we not? We've used them and we've run them into the ground and we've said to ourselves, "Ha, I'm justified. I can take a drink. I can smoke a joint. I can pop a pill, I can snort some coke." You know, rationalization, one of the big hang-ups that we have, one of the big, big disease concepts that we have. You know, Elmer didn't tell you that I work for the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Commission in Anderson, and I'm a very, very lucky guy to have this job. And understand that I've been doing this type thing with you people and other people throughout New York, New Jersey, and other localities for over 26 years. And for 26 years, I've been carrying the message. In the last five, I've been getting paid for it. Who could get luckier than I am? And, you know, I live on it. I love it. I'm almost in what you would call a compulsive state because I love to get to work. I love to meet the people, hard noses, rednecks, male, female, black, white, green, purple, orange. I don't care. As long as they got a problem or they think they have a problem or there is a problem that the family thinks they have, that's my bag. What joy, what greater joy could a person have in their lives is to pass on what we have to somebody else. That is really a joy. And to get paid for it is just a bonus. And I love it. And I wish that I had always been in this field, but it was God's will that I didn't get into it, that I had to go into other areas to broaden my scope, to become a better person, to learn how to live one day at a time like the program told me. And I wish I had this program when I was younger. You know, I think we all find our level when God wants us to. I don't think that the age of 18, when I was drinking pretty heavy, that I'd have come into AA and made it. I don't think at 25 I would have made it. But at 32, I did make it. So I was ready at 32. I guess enough things had happened to me during that time to make me realize that the drug alcohol had control and I didn't. And that's terrible. To give up your life to a drug, to let that particular substance tell you when to get up, when to go to bed, who to hang around with, where you work, where you go to lunch, where you go to dinner, and what you do when you get home. That's a lot of power in a drug to do that. It separates husbands and wives. It separates families. It separates friendships. It loses jobs. It kills people. Car accidents, accidents on the job, you name it. You've all heard about them, and you've all probably experienced them. I have. And, you know, for us to be sitting here tonight at the ebb of the Christmas holidays and just getting over Thanksgiving, we got to feel and we got to know in our hearts that we're the luckiest people in the world. Probably every one of us sitting out there should be dead, buried someplace, or at least in jail or in prison or in some hospital. Aren't we lucky? Aren't we very fortunate people to have found a 12-step program that can put our lives back together again? I feel I'm the luckiest guy in the world. You know, when I first went into the program and somebody got up and said they were Joe Blow and they were an alcoholic, you know, barf, you know, who wants to hear this? And, you know, and they went around the table and everybody introduced themselves the same way. And I said, well, you know, if all of these guys say they got a problem and they're all sitting around the table and they're sober, and this was 26 years ago, so we didn't have too many pot smokers or heroin addicts in those days coming in the door. I said, these guys must have something. These guys got to have something. I found a strength. Didn't you find a strength when you walked into your first meeting? Didn't you find a bunch of people that reached their hands out and said, welcome, and they meant it? You know, my life before AA, people were running away from me. People were walking down the street at me and would cross over so they wouldn't have to talk to me. Nobody in the world would hire me. Who the hell wants the drunken bum? Who wants somebody that says one thing and does another? Who wants anybody that makes promises and can't keep them? I'll give you a perfect example of that. You know, after I got into the program, things started to change around my house. I had two little children, and I was a widower, and they were 3 and 4 years of age. Prior to me getting into AA, I'd drive up or I'd walk up or whatever way I got home, crawl up most of the time, and I'd come in the front door. My two little kids would run upstairs. they'd take one look at me, and they'd go upstairs. Get out of Daddy's way. Daddy's looped. Stay away from him. Now, at 3 and 4 years of age, they certainly had no idea about addiction. They had no idea about chemical dependence. They had no idea about alcoholism or drug addiction. But they knew something was wrong with their daddy. But get the hell out of his way. And that they did. My parents, who were raising my children, they stayed in the kitchen, just stayed away from me. Let me go get my can of beer and sit in the living room. You know, I'm in the program a month, and I'm driving up to the door in the driveway, and both of those kids are knocking themselves out trying to get out the door so they could be the first one to jump in my arms. What a change. What a change. Just in those children's actions. Isn't that something to be thought about? My parents stopped frowning. They started smiling. My neighbors started to talk to me. My friends where I worked spoke to me. Wasn't so when I was using my drug. Now, I wasn't an alcoholic from the get-go, other than I loved the stuff immediately. I don't know how many other people here in this room can identify with the fact of taking your first drink, your first toke on a joint, your first hit of speed, or your first pill, and getting that sensation that you never had before. You see, I grew up, I was born scared. I don't know if anybody else was. And I was scared of people. My communication with people was terrible. I was afraid. I was shy. I was backward. I was just a big, stupid mess, really. If I was sitting in a classroom, and I had nuns for teachers, and a nun asked a question, and I knew the answer, I would not put my hand up. I was afraid I'd make a mistake. Very self-conscious about myself. Very self. And then all of a sudden, somebody introduced me to this marvelous liquid called alcohol. And I wasn't shy anymore. I wasn't afraid of anybody. I could communicate with the devil himself. And I said, where the hell has this been? And I'm 13, 14 years of age. Now, to stand here and tell you that I drank around the clock would be stupid, it would be foolhardy, but it was something I'll never forget, because that one feeling I had from my first experience with a drug, I never got again. Never. I kept trying to get it, I got close to it, but I never got that first experience back again. Can anybody here identify with that? And I kept trying to get that same feeling back again. And it was just impossible. I played a lot of sports. Alcohol didn't affect my sport playing. I was a good baseball player. The Philadelphia Phillies wanted to sign me in 1950. I had a scholarship to Dayton University for basketball and track. And I didn't go to either one of them. Now, I'm standing here tonight and telling you, that was two professions that I could have followed, of course, college and then on from there. But I didn't do it because I was afraid. I told you, I was born scared. I was afraid to move out of my neighborhood, afraid to go here, afraid to go there. Don't change my habits. Don't make waves. Let everything go the way it is. I was 17, and I was thinking this way. So what did I do? I went to work for a big oil company in New York. And the first thing they asked me to do or told me to do was that I would need a college education if I wanted to get ahead in the oil industry. So I enrolled at night to go to school at night when I had a 4-year scholarship. Now that makes a lot of damn sense, doesn't it? And I spent, I guess, the next 10 and a half years or 10 years of my life going to school at night, getting a degree. 2 years of that I spent in Korea during the Korean crisis. Now, while I was working with the oil company, I didn't drink, but occasionally I drank on weekends. I started playing industrial ball with the Standard Oil team. So I was still in good shape, but I was still drinking. But I have to be honest when I get up here, and I have to tell you in all truth that every time I drank until I fell down, I ran out of money, or I passed out or blacked out. I was a glutton. I loved the stuff, and I loved what it did to me. And during the Korean crisis, I got over there in Korea just at the tail end of it, and then we started to exchange prisoners, and my drinking habits got a little better and a little stronger and a little bit more into the liquor scene because we could get it so cheaply over there. So by the time I came back from the Korean crisis back to the oil company, I had a pretty good alcoholic syndrome going. I switched colleges at this time and went from engineering into business, and went into the public relations department, which was a drinking man's paradise as far as a big industry is concerned in New York. So my habit kept going on. I stopped playing ball. I stopped doing any physical activities. And at this particular juncture, I ran into a girl at the oil company. And as long as we were going out together, everything was fine and dandy. But when we got married, all hell broke loose. And I can't explain why. I mean, you know, this is, you know, the old story. Better off we shouldn't even have met, never mind get married. But we did get along once in a while because we had three children. But, you know, this in my lifetime was probably the most horrendous, traumatic, and horrifying experiences that I went through during my alcoholism. Now, we had a baby girl to begin with, and I was still moving up in the oil company and still going to school at night and still drinking pretty heavy. And then we had a baby boy, Thomas Jr., and Thomas was 6 months old when he died of bronchial pneumonia. Now, I mention this because I know a lot of people around at the tables here have had problems happen to them during their career, but I fell apart, and I fell apart for the wrong reasons. I fell apart not because I was worried about her or my parents or her parents or the child itself. I was worried about me. Me. I was so engulfed into the self again with this drinking, and I wanted to lose myself. So I did. I drank all during the wake, the funeral, everything else. I was a mess. I was a horrible person to be around. And she got pregnant again, and then she had a stillborn. I did the same damn thing. Dove right into the jug and stayed polluted for a good year, easy. And you know the only bad feature with it? Everybody at work empathized with me and said, "You poor guy, come on, let's go to lunch. Come on, let me buy you a drink." Just what I needed. And you know, it was getting worse and worse. I finished school in 59. And then I got married again to a young lady I met. We moved to Yonkers, and we had two children back to back, a boy and a girl, 11 months apart. Now, I'm not going to tell you that this was the greatest thing that ever happened or it was a wonderful, wonderful experience in my life. It was a happy time. It was a fairly decent time. I was still drinking, but I wasn't drinking around the clock. I drank every day. I worked every day. I was doing very well in the company. And after Nancy was born, 8 months later, she went into the hospital with a thyroid condition, and she died on the operating table. Now, here I was. I had an 8-month-old and a 19-month-old, and you know where I was headed, to the nearest bar. And I just picked those kids up and took them home to my parents and said, "Here you are, take care of them." And they did. Beautiful, wonderful enablers. They should have locked me up, but they didn't. And my mother and father, thinking that maybe, just maybe, if we changed locations or moved someplace, that I would stop drinking. So we moved upstate New York, about 60 some odd miles out of the city, to Monroe, New York. And my daily commute to New York was about an hour and 20 minutes by bus. And every night I got off work, I would go over to the Port Authority building on 42nd Street and pick up 2 pints of vodka, put 1 pint in my coat pocket and the other one in the inside pocket here, and I would sit in that bus on the way home, and in an hour and 20 minutes I'd kill one bottle. The other bottle I saved for the next morning, okay? And when I came down to New York the next morning, I had finished that pint. I would drive over or train over to the east side where our offices were, and I'd go into the Blarney Stone or the Blarney Castles. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever been in New York and looked at any of the bars or saw any of the bars. These are what would be referred to in the old days as speakeasy-type joints. And you know, when I was a young man and I had a lot of get up and go and I had a lot of ideals and I had a lot of wonderful, wonderful dreams, I'd look in these places and I'd say, oh, if I ever drink in those places, I'll stop. And here I was, 7, 8, 10 years later, going in there, getting a couple of drinks in the morning after finishing that pint of vodka on the way down, and then going into work. And then finding myself at 10 o'clock in the morning running out to get another shot in a cup of coffee. And then going out at lunch to get a few more beers. And then going out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to get another couple. And you know, I had a wonderful thing happen. It was wonderful for me. It wasn't too wonderful for the fellow that it happened to. But we had a man that coordinated all the national accounts for Standard Oil Company of New York. And that poor guy had a heart attack and died bowling one night. And he had been with the company 30-some-odd years, and nobody knew how he did his job or what his job consisted of or what it comprised except me, because I work with him every day. So they handed me the job. And here I was, a young man, coordinating all these accounts for Standard Oil, and a roaring drunk, a bum alcoholic. That's all I was. I couldn't think of the accounts. I could only think of when I was going to get my next drink. My thoughts were so confused that I couldn't put 2 sentences together. And you know, there's only a limit to how long people are going to put up with that kind of action. And on one particular day we had, this was during the early 60s, about 63. That was when the trucking industry was coming on strong, and we were making a bid to get all the oils and greases and kerosenes and all the diesels and whatnot that they used in the trucking business. And somebody called me up for a credit okay. And I approved $250,000 worth of credit over the phone, and I never looked these people up. This was after a 6-whiskey sour lunch. I'd approved Jack the Ripper for $1 million. The boss found out about it, and he called me into the office and told me about it. And I told him what he could do with the job, and he did it. So here I was. I just blew 13 years of my life. I'm standing out on 42nd Street, and I didn't know what to do, where to go, what I was going to do. Here I had these 2 babies at home. I didn't even know them. My parents weren't even talking to me. It was just a mess. I was such a coward. Again, I told you, I'm a scared cat. I couldn't even go home and tell them that this had transpired. I went home. I got pleasingly blitzed that night and then got up the next morning and traveled back into New York again. Then I got so drunk on the way home that night, then I told the folks what had happened. Of course, they kind of threw their hands up in the air and said, what's going to happen next, you know? Here they had 3 children that they were trying to take care of, my 2 and me. And I was probably more of a problem to them than Brian or Nancy. So I scoped around and looked for jobs, and I could never understand why these people wouldn't hire me. God, I had so much talent, all these years of experience, my education. I was so smart. God, these people should eat me up. Then I got into AA, and I looked back on it, and every time I went for an interview, I was drunk. Every time I went to fill out an application, I was stoned out of my mind. Who the hell's going to hire a drunk? So I ended up working for a bread company, delivering bread, Dugan's. And they were only about a quarter of a mile away from my front door. So the first 2 days, I went out with the boss. And this slob didn't even drink water. So by the time the end of the evening came, I was shaking apart and I was falling apart and I didn't know which end was up. But the third day, they sent me out on the truck by myself. And I rolled out of that barn about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I rolled back into that barn about 7 o'clock that night, and not one piece of bread had moved off that truck. And I fell out in the middle of the barn so drunk I couldn't even walk. Picked myself up, dusted myself off, and walked home. Now, would you believe that I reported for work the next morning? That takes a certain amount of, you know what. And I'll never forget this guy's name. His name was McCudden, a good Scotchman. And he fired me as I was stepping in the door. He said, "Get the hell out of my sight." And I said, "What's the matter? Didn't I bring the truck back?" You know. So, you know, when any time we get in problems, and I say we because I'm including you all in with me, we got to have somebody to talk to. Now, who the heck's the smartest person in the world that you know? Or that I knew at that time? The bartenders. They were the smartest cats I ever met. Man, they had an answer for everything. So I rolled out of old Dugan's Bread Truck Company line, and I went down to my local bar, and I ordered a beer. Then I ordered another beer, and that's the last thing I remember for 6 weeks. And I woke up in Middletown State Hospital for the cuckoo birds behind a 3x5 cage where they had me pinned in and labeled insane. Now, what had transpired is that I had probably more than two beers. I had 5, 6, 7, 8, who knows how many. I climbed back into my trusty Ford station wagon, which was built like a tank, and thank God it was, and I went ripping up the road 90 miles an hour, and where the road turned, I didn't, and I hit a trailer truck head on. And I hit this trailer truck so hard in the front that I knocked his auxiliary gas tanks off in the back. Now, this accident happened out here on the highway about 1,200 or 1,500 yards away from where my mother and father and the two kids were. They heard the sirens and everything else, but they didn't know what had happened. And what they did is they called the emergency squad. They pronounced me dead on the highway. They took me down to Tuxedo Hospital, where they brought me into the emergency room, and they labeled me dead on arrival, and they rolled me into the morgue, and they called the state police, and they told the state police to go up and tell my father that come down and identify the body. He's dead. So the cop went up to tell my father, and, you know, my dad told me, I guess I was 5 years sober. And when the state cop told him that I was dead, you know what my father said? Thank God. Thank God he's out of his misery. Thank God he's going to stop hurting. He knew I was hurt. He knew I was in trouble. He knew I really didn't want to do what I was doing, but I couldn't help myself. Meanwhile, I'm back in the morgue, and I'm laying on a slab, and I'm not bothering nobody. And this nurse's aide, who's just learning her trade, comes tippy-toeing into the morgue, and she starts shooting the stiffs with needles. And she hit me with adrenaline, and I sat up. She ain't been seen since. Well, they patched me up down at the morgue and got me all on the gurney. They didn't strap me on the gurney. And, you know, this is all hearsay because I don't remember any of it, and I hope I never do remember it. And I'm going down the hall being pushed, and I jumped off the gurney, and I started running down the hall, and all the attendants are running after me, and meanwhile my father's coming in the door to identify the body. That's him. Now, my dad lived to be 93. I don't know how the hell he did it, but he did it. I mean, my mother lived to be 87, so they packed me upstairs, and the doctor used to save me for his last call at night because I was unconscious, you know. My father said I was looking straight ahead. I could nod my head yes or no, but I had no conversation. He said my whole body from my waist down was black because I had ruptured all the blood vessels in my legs and my hips and everything else. He said he never thought I'd walk again. And the doctor saved me for the last turn. And one night he was checking on me, and he always brought his hat and coat in to me because I was his last customer. Meanwhile, an emergency happened down the end of the hall, and he went running down the end of the hall, and when he went running down the end of the hall, I put his hat and coat on and walked out the front door. Now, I want to tell you, folks, winter in New York is not like winter in South Carolina. The snow is piled as high as this ceiling. On either side of the road, the ground is all ice, and I'm trudging up the middle of Highway 17 with these paper slippers on, his hat and a coat, and I'm trudging up, and where do I go? The Duck Cedar Inn. It's a bar. Where else is a guy going to go? So I had worked up a terrible thirst. I climbed on the bar stool and then took the hat off. That was a big mistake. I shouldn't have done that because my head was all bandaged. And the bartender took one look at me, and I guess he saw the eyeballs were looking at one another. So he called the state police. They got to know me on a first-name basis. And they came and got me, and they took me back to Tuxedo Hospital. And Tuxedo Hospital says, we don't want him in here. They had to call my poor father to come all the way down to Tuxedo Hospital and sign me into the nut house. Again, he told me that was probably one of the toughest things that he ever did, but thank God he did. And that's where I woke up 6 weeks later in this screw bin. And I belong there. I accepted the fact that I belong there. You know, we have marvelous resilience, addicts. We can survive in any condition. I don't care what we put ourselves through or in or about, we survive. I would have been head nut up there if I'd have stayed. I'll tell you. I mean, that's just the way it is. Got to be top banana or nothing. So I went to an AA meeting once up there, and the only reason I went to the AA meeting is because I wanted some coffee and cake. I didn't get very much in my little 3x5 cell. So they took me down to the AA meeting, and the guy got up, and it was a room like this full of patients and all that kind of good stuff. And the guy gets up, and he says, I'm Tom White, and I'm an alcoholic. I shut him off. How could the guy have the same name as me? It's a setup. The doctors told him. The nurses told him. You know, so I didn't listen to a damn thing. Well, the guy's name was Tom White, and he does work. He works for the Grapevine in New York, so we got to know each other later. But they dismissed me from, or discharged me, I guess you'd say, from the hospital. And on the way home, I picked up a toy for my daughter, a toy for my son, and a case of beer for me. Doesn't everybody that comes out of a nut house do that? And, you know, I walked in the door, and my folks just threw their hands up in the air. Now, you know, I mentioned that I had this daughter from my first marriage, and I was sending money to her, but during this particular period of time, I didn't have any money, and poor Pop didn't have any money. So they called me into New York, and naturally, you know that I arrived straight and clean, right? Some case. The judge told me a few things. I told the judge a few things. I tried to grab him by the throat. The next thing you know, I'm in the pokey, and they throw me out on Hart's Island, and I'm in minimum security prison. So they had me in there for 6 months, but I ended up working for the warden. Again, you know, you get to the top. And I got out in 3. So what can I tell you? We're survivors. And I arrived home again with a toy for each child and another case of beer for me. So, you know, I got paid while I was working for the warden. And, you know, it was it was a constant rigmarole of lying, of cheating, of stealing, of just not being a person, almost an animal. You know, when you can think more of a stinking drug than you can of your own blood, something's wrong. Something is really wrong. And I got a job, finally, loading trucks, and I weighed 106 pounds at this juncture. Real powerhouse. But I'll tell you, my God started working. Well, I shouldn't say he started working for me. He was working a long time, but this is the first time I paid attention to him. And the guy where we were loading the trucks had a salesman there. His name was Gene, and he was in AA. And I went on a binge, the last binge, and I don't ever want to forget it. I drove the car to Middletown, parked it in the bus terminal, and then walked over to work. But this morning, I didn't walk over to work. I started drinking. So I didn't go to work. But I wouldn't drive that car either, not after that accident I was in. So for the next 4.5 days, I slept in that car. I panhandled money. I bothered people to death, wiping their windows with a dirty rag just to get a nickel or dime. And I was drinking 35-cent bottles of sherry wine, and that stuff is awful. I mean, you walk down the street and somebody taps you on the shoulder and you turn around, there's nobody there. That's what wine does to you. So, you know, the fifth day, or the end of the fourth day, I looked up and a bus pulled in across the street and my father got off the bus. Somebody had spotted me sleeping in the car and called him and told him where I was. And he started across the street, and I didn't think he was going to make it across the street. I guess we all have a moment of truth. I guess we all have an awakening. We talk about a spiritual awakening. Bill Wilson had a spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital. This was my spiritual awakening. I saw that man. I loved that man, and I knew I was killing him. But I was so sick, I didn't know how I was killing him. I really didn't. He took me home, took me to the doctor, and that's when I found out I was 106 pounds, malnutrition and dehydrated. I was on the verge of DTs, and I was a mess. But I went to work the next day. Did you ever know a drunk or a junkie to miss work? You got to have that money so you can pay off what you owe, and so you can buy more stuff. You know, they say we're weak-willed people. What a crock! We're the strongest will people that ever walked the face of the earth. Get an army of drunks together and you could conquer the world. You know, so I went back to work the next day and I told the boss that I thought I had a problem. And I told the doctor I might have had a problem and he mentioned AA. He didn't know anything about it. I went to work and told my boss and he said, talk to Gene, who was the salesperson. And I talked to Gene and Gene thought I was going to hit him up for some money so I could drink some more. And I asked him, what's this AA stuff? And he took me to a meeting. And that was September 1st, 1964. And I have not had a drink or a drug since. Now, I don't take any credit for it. I give you people that credit. I give AA that credit. I give God the credit. I couldn't even tie my shoelaces when I got into the program. I couldn't put two sentences together, as I mentioned before. But things started to change. I told you, 30 days and my kids were running out the door to jump in my arms. My parents were talking to me. I had a couple of bucks in my pocket. Things were okay. And then I got called back into New York for that daughter that I had from my first marriage, only to find out when I got into the courtroom, and I didn't know anything about it until I got there, that she had died. And they wanted me to be responsible for that, you know. And then, of course, my ex swore to the judge that she had notified me, and I know damn well she didn't, and I know my mother and father would have told me. But I got out of that without strangling anybody and going to jail, and made a commitment to pay for the funeral for my daughter, which I did. And when I went back to my boss, where I was loading the trucks, I was sober now, and he said to me, why don't you work in the office? And I'll give you some more money. And I said, well, don't give me any more money. Pay my loan. So he did. God started working for me. I was sober 90 days, and I sent in my license to be renewed, and they called me down to Goshen and said, you're supposed to be dead. I said, sorry about that. This is me. But they also had brought the truck driver in for the session. Well, that guy saw me, and he hugged and kissed me. Christ, I thought we were long-lost lovers. Here he thought he had killed me, and here I am standing in front of him. So the judge said, I got to take your license for 6 months. And I says, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that. Please don't do that. I says, I'm sober. I'm going to AA. I said, I'm trying to get my life back together again. He says, you're going to AA? I said, yeah. He says, can you live with 60 days? I got to take it. I says, I'll live with 60. Second miracle. The boss is paying my loan, and I get 60 days instead of 6 months. Now, you know that I didn't walk a step. And I mean, I'm not saying I cheated. I'm talking about you people with different names and with different faces. I'm talking about the AA people in Monroe, the AA people in Middletown, the AA people in Newburgh, and the AA people in Harriman. They didn't let me walk. They didn't let my parents walk. They ushered me all around the place. My sponsor ran my tail ragged to meetings. How can I ever, ever pay that back? How can I ever give back to you people what they gave to me? They gave me back my life. They gave me back my children. They gave me back the love of my parents. They gave me the ability to return to my spiritual bondage that I had. You know, I like to talk about the disease concept. You know, they say it's mental, physical, and spiritual. And, you know, I don't know about in your particular case, but in my case, when I started drinking, the first thing that left me was my spirituality. Because if my spirituality had lingered on, I might not have become a drunk. So my spirituality, how I connected to my fellow man, how I connected to my higher power, how I interacted in life in general, my spirit was dead. My spirit was gone, so I could keep on drinking. And then my mental started going, blackouts, mumbling, forgetting things, all the kind of stuff that we've all experienced. And then my physical, I told you I was 106 pounds. So I get into AA, and what happens in AA? I start getting feeling good. I start looking better, put on some weight. And they told me it's going to take me 2 years to get my brains out of hock. You know, I got mad as heck about that. But boy, were they right. Took me 2 years. And I'm not saying that I couldn't conduct myself as a human being. I'm talking about remembering things, remembering my past, being able to function, all the talents that I had wasted, that I had drowned in alcohol started to come back to me. My ability to do certain things in business world started to come back to me, but it took 2 years. It took probably longer than 2 years. 5 years to get your life is spirituality. You get your physical back first, and then your mental. But how you connect came to me last. Maybe all of you experienced it differently than I. And I'm a very fortunate man because my higher power not only saved my life, he's saving my son's life, who's straight. And, of course, my daughter is an addict too, but she's being watched over. He sent this beautiful creature to your left and my right into my life almost 10 years ago. And we hit it off like two peas in a pod. And then we started to get serious. And then she says, well, you know, we started talking about marriage. And I said, she says, well, when should we set the date? I says, when you're sober 2 years, baby, not before. Why? I says, I want your brains out of hock before I marry you. Well, she's a stubborn young lady because the day she celebrated her second birthday, she walked my butt down the aisle. And we had an AA marriage. We had all the attendants were AA or Al-Anon people. We had no booze. We had lots of cake, lots of soda, lots of coffee, and a lot of love. Man, a lot of love. Can't you feel it in this room? I can. I can feel this love just pouring out from everyone here. We really care about one another. We really trust one another. And we really want the best for each and every person sitting here. You know, life's too short to get yourself all bent out of shape. And I have the joy of working with potential, I have to use the word potential, addicts and alcoholics all the time. But I'll tell you, the groups in Anderson have tripled since I went to the commission because I send them all to AA or NA. I don't care what kind of programs we got in the commission, and we do have some good ones, and we got some marvelous, marvelous counselors. But I think there's two sides to every coin. Just like they told me when I came into AA, they said, if you got God in this hand, and if you got AA in this hand, you got nothing to pick up a drug with. And I'll agree to that. So if you've got AA or the amateur approach that we have, the loving approach and the professional approach, how can you go wrong? You got two sides to look at. And you know, Seal and I, we got married and we automatically had four children. And you know, without even raising a sweat, so figure that one out. And she has two girls and I got a boy and a girl, and three out of the four are addicts. So we have our fun practicing our Al-Anon program. And, in fact, Seal works down at the commission at night in one of our programs, which includes the Al-Anon, and she leads that once a week. So, you know, the wonderful thing about it is we start off each day, and this might sound trite to some of you, but, you know, you figure a lot of people out there, even maybe the young people, say, well, this sucker's been sober long enough. Why don't he just pack it in? Why don't he quit, you know? I don't want to quit. I don't want to pack it in. First of all, if I did, I've seen too many experiences and too many people that have tried to do it their way and die. I don't want to die yet. I mean, if I'm going to die, I want to die sober, and I want to die clean, and I want to die happy. And I've never been happy in my life until I reached the doors of AA. And I didn't know what total happiness was until I married Seal and we teamed up and we got the kids. We got three out of the four squared away. And now we got two grandbabies. In fact, next Thursday we're flying to New York to see the gang. So, you know, life is full of joys and life is full of pleasures. Why would anybody in their right mind want to dull that with a drug? I lost too much of my life. I don't know about you people. All the happiness that I should have endeared and remembered today, I can't. I can't remember because it's all clouded and it was all destroyed because I was a suffering addict. But thank God we don't have to do that today, do we? We got each other, we got a program, and we got God. Thank God we got our higher power. Because without that marvelous strength and that wonderful, wonderful, powerful, encompassing love that he sets out for us to share, it's the greatest thing in the world. You're the greatest bunch of people in the world. And I want you to remember one thing, and one thing real loud and clear. Remember that we laughed a little bit tonight. We had a couple of chuckles, a couple of smiles. But please don't ever, ever forget you've cried. Thank you.